Welcome back, WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. Says so on the hat. Don Mohler, I don't get dressed up for many people, but former colleagues, every once in a while I'll put on a collared shirt here. All of our Baltimore Positive coverage brought to you by our friends at State Fair and El Guapo out on Frederick Road. I got to get out there. I'm so craving that chicken from the Chicken and Waffles. The shrimp and grits I had a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to get that Bavette steak. He took the meatloaf off the menu. I got to have a talk with Evan about that. Our friends down at Fadley's are shipping those crab cakes world class all over the world, anytime, one click away. And, of course, you can always get out of Lexington Market and curbside. You can stop in now and have an oyster if you wish. Now that Brandon Scott has opened up the city, we do encourage everyone to do that. And if you missed our conversation with Don Mohler's offspring, Jeff Mohler, who is selling houses with Mohler and Gary, we had a great conversation about the Ravens offseason. But more than that, the real estate market and where it's headed, you can check that out at Baltimore Positive. Don, you're inviting a guy on that apparently remembers me, and very few do remember my time. My 6 years and 9 days, illustrious at the Baltimore Sun from January 6th of 1986 until January 15th of 1992. Peter Jensen was apparently there, right?
Yes, I was there. And in fact, you were well known in the building, Nestor, even
for screwing up the lottery numbers? What was I known for?
It was like this. You talked fast. You bounced off the walls, and you were like just like 18 or something. You were very young at the time, as I recall. And we started around the same time in like 86. You were the evening sun, as I recall.
What was your role then?
I was first hired to be the Eastern Shore correspondent. So I was not around hardly at all. You would never have seen me, except when I came to Calvert Street periodically. I would always have lunch with a bunch of the sports guys. And they were always talking about you and this crazy kid that bounces off the wall. So I did make a point to see you in action at some point.
And it turned out well. I mean, it turned out okay.
It did. Well, in fact, your career going into radio is, I think, was a perfect fit. And so it was. You've done really well. And
I'm trying to get out of it. Let me know. You know, it's been 30 years, you know, so
we're all proud. There's so many graduates, you know, Sun graduates. We're all proud of them. But
that's very sweet of you. See that, Don? You invite guys on to compliment before we even get going. Now, how am I going to have a relevant conversation with him?
Time's up, I guess. So it's we'll
it's a special club down there at what was Calvert Street.
That's right.
I was taught well. I'll say that, Peter, of everything, you know, that, and I say this to my wife all the time with all these crazy Trumpers and Hollies and all this. I said, I spent my life asking questions and questioning what truth is. I do it professionally. I've done it every minute of my life. And I guess a lot of people, you know, it was a wonderful training for a wife, a life well lived, I would say, questions.
Well, here's the thing. And people should understand that in the heart of, I found, of every sports guy is a political commentator struggling to get out. And in the heart of every political commentator is a guy who wants to write about sports.
I've unchained. I've gone like this.
Exactly.
It's all Mohler's fault. I got together after he ran the county and I said, "You ran the county? You were my high school guidance counselor. You know, come on, man. Give me some wisdom." So here we are. And I'm so sorry it took us 2 years to bring you on. Mohler, Glassman didn't compliment me like this. I mean, Pam Moore doesn't do these things.
No,
you know?
But Barry did indicate that you were up on the fact that he is a sheep farmer, and he appreciated that. We're going to get into Mr. Glassman and First District and that stuff with Peter Jensen from the Baltimore Sun. Peter, I have to tell you, you and I have known each other for so long, and like to think we have a friendly relationship. We've butted heads from time to time. There were a few times when you were on the other end of a phone call when I said, "What the hell are you writing about my boss?" Do you remember any of those, Peter?
Absolutely.
He probably thought you were being dishonest to him. That's what reporters do.
Don, if you think that you're the only guy who called me like that, you are so wrong. My life is about getting those calls. So
no doubt about it. But I always do like, I've always pointed out to folks, and that was whether it was you or Andy or whoever, that we could have those battles and then move on. I remember, I don't know if it was to you, one of our very good supporters at Baltimore Positive, Peter, or the folks at Center Maryland and KO Public Affairs and Damian O'Doherty.
Yeah.
And I'll never remember the day that he was screaming at Andy. I mean, he, you know how Damian can get. He was screaming like only Damian can scream. And I could not hear what Andy, and folks, that's Andy Green, who used to be with the Sun as an editor. I couldn't hear what Andy was saying, but Damian was screaming so loud that I thought I'd have to open the windows in the car. And he kept screaming, "I know I'm screaming. I know I'm screaming. I'm Irish. We scream. We scream."
Can I make an aside on that point, which is that some of the people, including the folks in the governor's office now, don't understand that the loudest I've ever been screamed at was by the O'Malley people. They were screamers more than any Republican had ever.
You mean Mr. Carney and Mr. Abruzzi? Yeah,
Mr. Carney, yes, Mr. Carney
actually raised his voice.
Oh yeah.
I've heard of his reputation.
Yes.
You know. Yes. You know. We're. Yeah. I apologize to our listeners for this inside baseball, but you mentioned Steve Carney again, one of the partners at KO Public Affairs when he was with Jane Miller, who's a good friend. And we've had Jane on the show. She called one day and yelled at me. She was mad at me over something. And one of her opening lines in that conversation was, "What are you and Carney get up first thing in the morning and compare notes and decide?" And I said, "Well, man, Steve and I don't talk while I'm brushing my teeth." But it's been a lot of fun. You know, Peter, that's a good segue, I think. You have so much to talk about in your career and what you've gone through. But that kind of back and forth with the press really is what, among so many other things, took a hit the past 4 years, right? In terms of the way people view a free press.
There's a lot of things that's taken a hit in press-wise. It's one of the frustrations you have is that people, average people, never really see what's involved close up with our work. What they see as like deliberate, hedging of the news of putting a spin on things is actually not that at all. And if they sort of could live that life of seeing the actual intent of giving objective, reasonable reports on the most vital news of the day, they would, I think, understand where we are a lot better. But unfortunately, it's now become so politicized. And it's coming at simultaneously at a time when the media landscape is changing fundamentally, I don't want to get into those things, but it has to do with the internet and with business models and things like that. But it is unfortunate that people think it's have a very narrow and I think unfair view of what the press does. And of course, I say that as an opinion writer who we get calls periodically from people who say, "How come your editorial was so biased?" And of course, that's the whole point of the editorial.
Well, we're going to talk about a couple, a recent op-ed and then one that actually was an editorial. But one of the things I was struck by, Peter, when you and I communicated off the air, you now have more years in the editorial room than you did as a beat reporter at The Sun. Yeah. Is that accurate? Yeah.
It's about even right now. It's now flipping to more years in opinion. Yeah.
So talk about the shift and the different. And Nestor loves the journalism discussions. Talk about the shift to the opinion room, to the editorial room, and also take people behind the curtain, Peter. Editorial writers are fond of saying, we're separate. We're separate from the reporters. Yeah. There's this wall that's built up. Take people behind what that means when you say we're separate from the reporters.
Oh well, it's separate in every way possible. In that the editorial department, the opinion editor, the deputy opinion editor, editorial writer, we have. Other than physical proximity, have nothing to do with reporters and editors and people who put out the main part of the newspaper. We just meet as a group and decide what should be the opinion of the paper. We what reporters think or editors think is immaterial to us. We're just trying to draw some conclusions about events based on our own, talking to people ourselves. As you know, we go out and interview people and bring people in to talk to us and do our own research and come up with our own conclusions. So the reporters doing their own thing would never talk to me or to others in our department. That's just not common.
Yeah, enough. I never like went up to a columnist and recommended, hey, this is what my opinion is. You should have it, right? Like literally, but the enemy of the press part of this, right? And I had a little fun with this the other night with Curt Schilling not getting into the Hall of Fame. He married a childhood friend, the whole deal. But the rope tree journalist, awesome, you know, all of that. What happened at the Annapolis Capitol is very real. What this 4 years has begat with state houses in Michigan and what we saw at the Capitol a couple of weeks ago. But the spin on it and the notion that if you were all in on Trump, there's no way to not be. Changing people's minds is probably the most difficult thing that in the new world. It used to be, well, I'm open to that, or, well, give me some more information. There's no more of that. And I guess the internet and the silos we keep and in the words we keep all get looked at by these algorithms and social media, and we just get what we already believe thrown back at us. And that's very obvious for any of us that spend any time on social media.
No, Nestor, you're absolutely right. And it was sometimes you sit down and you wonder, who are you writing your opinion piece for? Are you writing it to convince someone to change their mind? Or are you writing to get, are you writing for the choir, essentially, and just trying to get people to be excited about reading you? Or are you just writing for page views? Are you just trying to be ornery and be different and provocative? It can always be a struggle. But at the heart of, I like to think of opinion, should be the idea that we believe in something. The person who's writing that truly believes they're right and needs to make that point. And if you don't have that, I just think it comes through as sort of heartless recitation of talking points.
Well, we just had a presidential campaign. You know, I almost ran for mayor, right? So my wife, the first thing she says, you got to have a platform. You got to have a platform. So I put a platform together. I never ran. Trump ran for president without a platform. I mean, there was nowhere to go to even look to see what he believed, right? Like, that's kind of an incredible thing to where we are for reading and words. And Peter, I say this to Don all the time, and you talk about me being a young whippersnapper and a fast talker and all that stuff. I wrote a book on the Ravens championship 7 years ago, and I went down to Ocean City for the Ravens Roost convention. And I thought, man, there's 20,000 Ravens fans. They all love the team. It's only $20. It's got a lot of great stories in it, stories that I didn't even know. I had 20,000 people. I sold 20 books. I had everyone came by me and they all said the same thing. I don't read new books. I don't read new books no more. And they just elected a president for 4 years who clearly has never read a book. Just the notion of reading. You know, I think we all take it for granted in this, you know, in our little world here that we all read and we're all well-read and we've all studied up on civics and went to school. There are a whole bunch of people that, like, stopped reading in eighth grade or ninth grade and still got a diploma, right? That's the hardest part, is reaching people with your words who aren't open to any new idea no matter what. So when you talk about persuasive speech or persuading people to do anything, I've always thought like editorial writing would be at its heart persuasive without trying to be, without arm twisting. Just saying, here are the facts, here's a strategy, here's what I think, but you got to get somebody to come and read it. And I think in this country, that's one of the real problems we have, is people read tweets, but they don't read white papers, man.
No. But that's always been true. I mean, it's if you look at the history of journalism, there were always tabloids. There was always some yellow journalism. There was always an effort to you know, pamphlets that tried to be provocative. It's the human nature to be attracted to some more incendiary ideas and less to long pontification. It's too easy to just dismiss all the Trump voters as you know, uneducated and uninterested. There's something else going on there too, of that sort of tribalism, desire to feel belonging to something. I think there's a certain amount of white fear of change, of the growing impact of a more diverse culture, of the switch from manual and blue collar labor more to technical work. There's all kinds of, I mean, I'm not giving excuses for things, but there's a lot going on that I think contributes to this problem beyond people having a lack of curiosity about the world.
Critical thinking, though. Critical thinking.
Yeah.
I do think, Peter, that boy, you did a nice little summary there, because I think, and again, you know, you've written about it. I've tried to write about it. Trying to summarize the Trump voter is very, very challenging. And when I put, you know, fingers to keyboard, used to be, you know, pen to paper, now it's fingers to keyboard, and try to capture everything that is about that group, it's very difficult. And again, you do it well. We are with Peter Jensen, editorial writer with Baltimore Sun, been with the Sun since 1986. Always, Nestor and I always put in a plug for journalism. If you're not getting the Sun either digitally, online, or delivered to your driveway, please do so. We need a free press. Very, very important in the United States of America. Peter, I want to talk a little bit about a piece that you wrote, and not only about the piece itself and what motivated and drove the piece, but I'm going to go out on a limb and saying the editorial that Sun ran in July 27, 2019, entitled "Better to Have a Few Rats Than to Be One," probably is the most viral thing that a Peter Jensen has ever written. Is it safe to say that was the most viral piece you've ever written?
Well, let me say this, Don. After I wrote that, and the next morning, I got a call from the BBC in London to do a live broadcast with them. Caught me, gave me wind that maybe something had been a little different about this particular editorial, because that,
right.
yeah, it went a little viral. It was, I don't know if it's true or not, but at that moment, it became the most read thing that had ever appeared in the Baltimore Sun.
Well, I mean, Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Kimmel, they were all talking about it. I mean,
speak to the Baltimore pride part of that. I mean, we're Baltimore positive. I live in the city, and, you know, full disclosure for me, the reason I even started doing this was after Freddie Gray, I kept my mouth shut. I went back and talked about football and baseball and all that stuff, and I wasn't seeing things get better, and I felt like there needed to be people needed to speak out, and in order to lift Baltimore, we need to do that. Part of anything that says Baltimore on it, I've gotten to the point where these people that say they're never coming back to the city, I'm like, well, then get out of my life. Because if you're never coming back to the city, you're not here to help it. And I think it's for all of us to lift it. And I think deep down, when I read it, I looked at it in the same way I would look at my Ravens stuff or my Oriole hat, or the reason I became a sports fan, to say, that's my town. You know, come on now. I mean, this is where I live. We're not going to let you talk about us like that.
I think that was at the core of that editorial. I mean, I remember it was a Saturday where he made this. He posted these comments about Baltimore on his happily now defunct Twitter account, and I just thought it was so unfair, so destructive, that it screamed at me. And so I drove into work and banged that thing out in about 2 hours.
Go ahead, Peter. Go ahead.
No. I mean, I think what Nestor says at the heart, it's about striking back. And in fact, I tried to use language to sort of replicate the president's thought process at that point, and what he might actually pay attention to or affect him. So,
and what you did in the beginning, I mean, right out of the gate, Peter, in that editorial, you gave the president's words right back to him. You wrote, here are the key phrases. No human being would want to live there. It's a very dangerous and filthy place. It's the worst place in the USA. And you said your personal favorite, it's a rat and rodent infested mess. I mean, that's the kind of rhetoric we got used to from the president. What I'm fascinated by, Peter, I'll kid with you from time to time when I read an editorial, having read you for many, many years, I sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong, but I have a sense what I'll call Jensenisms. I'll see a phrase or two in there and I'll go, okay, I know who wrote that editorial. And a lot of times I'm right. Occasionally I whiff. You guys typically are anonymous when writing an editorial. This one had suddenly became Peter Jensen's piece. How did that happen?
Well, I, first of all, I think it's wrong to describe editorials as anonymous. They're not. They're not signed because they're products of a board, of an editorial board that debates things and essentially formulates the position together. So it, I think it would be misleading to have a byline on an editorial. Although it's true that one person usually ends up writing it, you'll notice we run at the bottom of editorial a credit to the full editorial board with their names, because I think that's a little more accurate. But I would say there was a little of my personality in there because because I am a little sarcastic.
Occasionally. Just occasionally.
Just a little. And I think sometimes it's more effective to put in some personality, like you and I were talking, or like it was a small group and we were at the bar with beers and we were just trying to convince each other of something. I think injecting a certain amount of personality is effective in argument. So yes, that'll sometimes come out more.
I've been doing that for a long time. Put a little personality in.
Right. Yeah. You're all personality.
Well, come on now. There's some substance here as well.
But, yeah, no, I don't doubt that. No, there's a lot of personality. There's a lot of personality.
I was going to ask you about that. Your defense of Baltimore on behalf of the paper, on behalf of your job, or on behalf of, hey, I love it too. I mean, you've been here 34 years, right? Right into the sun. Give me a little primer on Baltimore for you in defense of Baltimore, other than just an F you to Donald Trump. I mean, I defend Baltimore all the time to people, but believing in Baltimore, I know Don asked Jane Miller about this, and Jane didn't have the answer we expected, quite frankly, 6 months ago, which was the future of Baltimore and how it gets better and how the trajectory changes.
Before you answer, Peter, for those who are listening, if you want to hear that Jane Miller interview, go back out on the Baltimore Positive podcast and listen. And not that Jane was negative in any way. She's as Baltimore gets, as you know, Peter. But she was concerned. And I think that's what Nestor's alluding to. She was concerned that Baltimore was in a very challenging place. And as someone who loved it, wasn't as optimistic as she would like to be. Now, jump back to Nestor's question. Where is your perspective on Baltimore?
All right. Well, listen. About 40 to 50% of the content of my page is criticism of the city's leadership decisions. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's any subject which we write about more often than problems of the city. So this idea that somehow Baltimore is ignoring its problems or is not confronting its problems, which was inherent in the president's criticism, is just so false. But what motivates me personally, and let me say, I am not Baltimore born and raised. I was born down the road in D.C., which, although nearby, has a certain otherworldly quality to it. I've sort of adopted the Baltimore area. I've married and raised a family here. And one of the things, advantages you have as a reporter is you meet a lot of people. You meet people who are on the front lines of police work, of hospital work, of community organizers, of people who are trying to make a difference, people who are invested in Baltimore, people who have devoted their lives to making this a better place. And to dismiss them, you know, just without more than a second's thought on the matter, because someone, as you recall, this started with a video of trash on the streets of West Baltimore.
By a Republican operative who is mostly out of her mind, yes.
Yeah, and doesn't even live in the city. It was just...
Who we invited on the show, and she wanted to write the questions. And I said, probably not. Ooh. Probably not going to work here.
Well,
maybe you do that over CBM. You don't do that at WNS.
Yeah, it's another. That's a whole different subject. Anyway, so that's just, I mean, it just hits you somewhere hard because it's just so incredibly unfair and insulting to people who have devoted so much effort to making this a better place, and so much is stacked against Baltimore in a way that that these people who can criticize so easily don't understand, particularly down to the racism and classism and fundamental social problems that that historically have confronted Baltimore and have not been solved.
Well, we had Antero on, you know, in regard to his book. And I'll be honest, Peter. I mean, I've been doing this a long time in the sports side and the Free the Birds and all that. I went to Don 2 years ago and I said, when before Kathy was going to prison, you know, this was just when I was seeing the city begin to deteriorate, the crime numbers, all that stuff. And I said, who's making it better? Where are the good people here? You know what I mean? And I guess I was in my own little silo for a long time, seeing people at events or whatever, but saying, who's really trying to make a difference? And that's why I went full swim into Baltimore Positive for exactly what you said. And I said this to my wife. I said, man, there's some really good people here. Yeah. We ought to be able to figure this out. We have really good people here. We have resources. We have location. We have all sorts of assets. How do we harness that? And really, a lot of this would speak to Trump. Bad leadership will get you blown up every time, right? And we've really had a spate of that here the last 2 decades.
And that discussion that Nestor had, Peter, led us to really sit down and have important discussions with folks like Sarah Heminger at Thread, who's just doing life-changing work. I mean, you know, Sarah Heminger.
Talk about Dante Barksdale, which is
and Dante, which took our breath away. Speaking of what Peter Jensen writes, so we have the, and I like the way you put it, it's not that they're anonymous. They're written by the whole editorial board. Typically, one editorial writer assumes the bulk of the work on a particular piece. But then there was a recent op-ed where a Mr. Peter Jensen put his name on the piece dealing with the first congressional district. And let me just share a little, if people would like to know when Mr. Jensen says he has a certain style, let me just do a little bit of a dramatic reading of part of that piece. If honor meant anything to Mr. Harris, he would recognize his misdeeds and tender his resignation right now. Not because he's a Republican, not because he is politically conservative, not because he has long been a fawning toady to President Trump. That would be a take for me if I were reading a Jensen piece. Parenthetical, district voters presumably endorsed his servile obedience to the liar in chief when he was reelected by a 63% to 36% margin in November. Close parentheses, but because he blatantly rejected his oath of office and obligation to defend the Constitution in attempting to overturn the election, consistently and knowingly misrepresenting the vote, and then for sanctioning, if not outright encouraging, last week's riot that resulted in the deaths of at least 5 individuals, including Brian Sicknick, a 42-year-old Capitol Police officer. I think you have levied the case against 1st Congressional District Representative Andy Harris. Talk a little bit about what prompted that piece, Peter, having covered the good congressman for many years.
Well, that column sort of speaks for itself. I think that anyone who has followed the 1st District recognizes that he has been a terrible representative of for the state of Maryland, down to, you would think, when your district essentially covers much of the Chesapeake Bay, that you'd at least be invested in, for instance, cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay. But he's not even that. It is such a failure of leadership that his presence there is only because, really, the Democrats so badly gerrymandered the district to make it, you know, a district that sort of centers on the Eastern Shore all the way into Cockeysville, where he lives, and beyond, you know, into northern Carroll County, taking out with it some of the most conservative bastions in the state. That's why he even, you know, is there. To allow the state to have 7 Democrats, but just 1 Republican in Congress.
Peter, talk about that piece a little bit, that not piece, but that comment that you just made, because again, Nestor and I have talked about it before. We've talked about it with John Sarbanes. We've talked about it with pretty much every elected official.
All you have to do is hold Sarbanes' map up and say, explain this.
And John knows how crazy his district is. Dutch's district is crazy. We go around the state. We go around the Western Maryland district where David Trone represents. They're all crazy districts. I have this premise and shoot holes in it, which you're more than capable of doing, that there are many reasons why we ended up in this tribalism that you talk about, but this desire on the part of both parties across the nation to gerrymander these districts, to create what we call quote unquote safe districts, where
fixing the game,
where moderation is not rewarded.
Right.
And compromise is not rewarded, really has taken us down this rabbit hole. But I also believe when people criticize Maryland and want Maryland, that you can't fix it state by state, that it has to be a federal solution. Just curious as to your take on that.
Yeah, I think I made that point in the column that or maybe in some other piece I wrote, that state level solutions don't seem effective because in order, for instance, Maryland to switch back to districts that might lead to a, you know, say a 4-4 split like the state once had in Democrats and Republicans in Congress, in the House of Representatives, rather, you would in that part potentially surrender the Democratic majority in the House, which would be disastrous for Maryland's interest. So unless other states, Republican-run states, did the same thing, you would be demonstrably penalized for doing the right thing. That's a problem. And yet at the federal level, if you want to say, you know, this is how you have to do districting, you'd have to pass that through Congress with a 2/3 majority. That's not going to happen. So I there's no easy solution in sight. But yet the only way, you know, some states have already come around and created independent groups, you know, commissions to advise on district boundaries, which is probably the best solution available. But that's only because they have voter initiatives and can sort of circumvent their state legislatures. We don't have that in Maryland, and so it's not going to happen.
Once again, we're with Peter Jensen, the Baltimore Sun editorial page. Peter, before we let you run, because you've been very much, or at least I don't know, very much involved, maybe an exaggeration, but you've been certainly interested in the whole Save the Sun effort. You've followed what's happened to print journalism, which is very concerning to Nestor and me and the future of print in the United States. And Peter, did I just read, or am I mistaken, that the Trib actually announced it was giving raises, but only to its employees who were not members of a union? I mean, did I misread that somewhere?
Yesterday, we received notification that there would be some kind of bonuses handed out. And the first group to receive the bonuses will be the non-union employees, and that union employees will have to have the situation negotiated. That's a fairly standard approach when you have a company with some people union represented and some not, to have some level of bargaining. Hopefully the bargaining will be just routine and not, they won't be looking for concessions or something like that. So yes, it's true, but it's probably unfair to say there's no intention to provide bonuses for all employees. But I think no one's talked about dollar numbers. I think in time we'll understand that the bonuses will be so small that I don't know why we're even arguing about who's getting them and who's not getting them.
So it's not even going to allow you to take your family to an Oriole game and get a couple of dogs, huh?
Maybe. I have no idea. I would say that, you know, as we mentioned previously, touch on the posture of the company and the industry is such that it's not like there's a lot of money sitting around. As far as the Save Our Sun thing, I'm hardly an expert on where things stand. We're all hopeful that we might be, instead of end up in the hands of a hedge fund notorious for wiping out the papers it owns, that we might end up either in a status quo or in the hands of Stuart Bainum, of the Montgomery County millionaire who has expressed interest in buying the paper. So,
well, Peter, I was struck early on, and again, Nestor, this goes back to when you began at the Sun. I looked at when it says Peter Jensen started as the Eastern Shore reporter for the Baltimore Sun. At that time, I'm guessing not only were there Eastern Shore reporter or reporters, I know we had several reporters in Baltimore County, actually had a bureau, yeah. You know, long manned by Larry Carson, yeah. and others, you know, good old Larry living large out there in Harrod County. I hope he's
still writing. Yeah, still writing letters to the editor, might
I. There you go. Larry still, and one of the great budget experts. I mean, I could count every year on the dates that Larry was going to call with specific budget questions because he knew what he wanted to know, and he was a serious reporter. You had foreign reporters. I look at this skeletal staff now that exists with the Sun, still trying to put out a paper. Walk our listeners through this evolution, just in your 30 years there, of what has happened at papers like the Sun.
Well, it is striking. And I think people can catch on just by lifting the Sunday paper and noticing that in 30 years, it went from being this doorstop to being able to fit between the door and the stop. You know, it's quite a difference. When I came to the Sun, as you said, there were six or seven foreign bureaus. The Washington Bureau had its own office in D.C. There must have been seven or eight people there. There were every county had its own bureau on top of having a local edition. You know, there was the Arundel Sun, the Howard Sun, and that sort of thing. And there was the editorial board, of which I'm now a part, was about 10 people, and it's now three. So it's yes, there's
gives you more power.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's true. I get to write as long as I want. Yes. And the other, but what has happened obviously over time, and what people should notice is the advertising has essentially dried up. Because it's gone elsewhere. Again, back in the Sunday paper days, one of the thickest sections used to be the classified ads. Well, there's essentially no such thing as newspaper classified ads anymore. That's a thing of the past. And because the internet killed that. And a lot of the display ads, companies would much rather advertise on social media or other internet sites where they can tell the they can run the ad to somebody who has already expressed intent on buying their product. Why would you go in this general circulation newspaper when you can buy something specifically gleaned to show up on the pop up on the Facebook page of someone who's already run a search for that item on Amazon or wherever? It's just much more cost effective for employers. And so, you know, you just run the gamut of all those things. And it's funny because in terms of page views, the Sun is as capable as it's ever been. We have people who do some wonderful journalism. We are until the title passes hands again, the Pulitzer Prize winning for local newspaper in the world. It's even diminished.
Kathy'd still be running the city right now and have her house.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Yeah. So they do the best with what they can, but. But it's probably, you know, it's probably fair to say we have maybe a quarter of the manpower of what we used to have. And of course, you know, back then when we had both the Evening Sun and the Morning Sun. So, yeah, maybe the staffing is about that.
Yeah, remarkable. Hey, Peter, before we let you run, I know it's early. We're in the infancy of a Biden presidency. But you've covered politics a long time. You have a gut. You have an instinct. What's your gut tell you as to how Joe Biden has done so far and what we might encounter going forward?
I am hesitant to draw a lot of conclusions after a week. It's a little early to do that. I would say the most impressive thing so far has been his appointees are like so much more qualified than the last administration.
Well, they are qualified. Let's start with that.
That's right. Like, I mean, that's the most significant thing right now. I think long term is that he's going to have people around him and know what the hell they're doing in a way that the last regime was frightening.
Well, I mean, every day we wake up. I mean, we're 9 days into his presidency. I wake up today. Everything, we had half an hour, Barry Glassman. Everything is about vaccine, vaccine, vaccine. Well, they clearly screwed that up. They clearly had gross incompetence at every level, and they've left. They've parked that on Biden's doorstep. I said to my wife the other day, "How many other things do you think that we're never going to know about? Like, well, just even what went on in the White House." That they wouldn't let Biden in, and, you know, until noon that day. Just crazy stuff that they're never, and Biden can't complain about it, right? Biden can't say the vaccines are screwed up because the other guy was incompetent.
Right. Well, can you imagine if he had approached this first 9 days as his predecessor would have approached it? It would have been, I mean, things would be incredibly ugly right now. He would be sneering and lying and doing all the other mechanisms, you know, you had before. The country would be at sea and with little hope of getting back on some normal, some rational, some reasonable footing. And in the middle of a pandemic, I think I bet you're going to see pretty soon some polling that is going to show the country feels better about itself and that the Biden approval rating is higher than his predecessor's approval rating at any point in his
presidency. I saw one, Peter, one of the early ones. I think it was, I don't know if it was Pew or someone the other day, did a quick snapshot. And again, it'll change dramatically because we're so early. But at 1 week in, they did a comparison to Trump. One week in, Trump was at 46%. It was the highest approval rating that he ever achieved. He never hit 50. He's the only president who never hit 50. So he was 1 week in at 46, and 1 week in, Biden was at 63. So the sense of normalcy has had an impact. It's interesting. I was speaking to an uncle the other day. He's 79 years plus. And by every measure, I would say to folks, as politically moderate can be. He's a lifelong businessman. He's not left. He's not right. He's pretty much dead smack in the middle. And he got into a debate the other day with someone who still wanted to try to support the past president. And my uncle's response was, but truly, be honest with me. Don't you feel better waking up every day without a knot in your stomach? And I thought that's really prophetic.
I find myself going on Twitter less just because I don't think the world's going to blow up. Literally. Yeah.
I think so. In fact, well, you know, and I'm not a Twitter person at all, but I did have to keep a bookmark on the president's Twitter account because you never knew what might be said or done that would completely.
But here's the thing. What difference did it make? In the end, what difference did any of those words, any of that, all other than the people that were actually affected by it, in the end?
Oh, Nestor, I think it made a huge difference. I think it continues to make a difference.
Yeah, I agree.
I think.
Oh, him being off makes a difference. I would agree. I would agree with that.
Public trust in our institutions of government, I bet you'll find, is quite low right now. And the sort of tribalism we started the show with talking about, I think it's more manifest because of this sort of behavior. It's caused people to take sides in a really ugly way, and I think the legacy of that is going to last a long time yet.
Decades, Peter. I say that all of the time. The destruction of the norms, the term that I think people are writing about now and that you're hearing about, is this, that the norms, what he did to norms, he established new norms and he destroyed old norms.
Maybe I said that the wrong way. Maybe what my point is, he hasn't been punished for it. All that awful stuff that you bookmarked and looked at, it just all came and went.
Right.
And nothing was ever done about it, you know? And I guess that's where the impeachment comes in, which is going to dominate everything the next couple of weeks, right? For better or worse, because I have no idea how it's going to work out.
And I think we do.
I'll make a prediction there.
Yeah. Peter and I'll jump in on that. It's the same way I feel about where this GameStop thing is going to end for people who are putting thousands of dollars in GameStop. You know, the other, Nestor, you said, and then
where's it going to end?
I gotta call my broker if Don's giving me advice on GameStop.
Yeah,
sell.
I got a good feeling. Exactly. I got a feeling that's not going to end well for a lot of folks.
But you know,
Nestor, you said the impact of the tweets, and then you went back and sort of, you know, corrected it a little bit. Two summers ago, I was in London, and my nephew has a good friend, a college friend, who was over there for an international finance firm. And I was with my brother and sister-in-law, and we had dinner with this young man one night. And he's certainly far from a left-leaning liberal. I mean, this guy's in international finance. He was pretty much a traditional Republican, down the middle kind of guy. And he, at that point, was pulling his hair out because he said he was dealing with clients every day who were making decisions that affected millions and millions of dollars. And it goes to what you said, Peter, about bookmarking the tweets. He said, I've never in my life tried to have to navigate around the thought that we could cement a deal or make a decision, and then 5 minutes later have that undone by a tweet that would affect the market in millions and millions, if not billions, of dollars. The erratic nature of that and the return to normalcy just feels different. Now, what that's worth long term, we'll see. My gut tells me, Peter, that if, and it's easier said than done, that if sometime by September or October, this virus is truly under control, the vaccine has been distributed, and pent-up demand in the nation in terms of trips and restaurants and all the other things that go with the economy, I think there's a good chance that the at least the first term of the Biden presidency is looked upon fondly. But as you said, it's pretty early.
Yeah, it's too early to tell, and I think there's just as good a chance that as the pandemic drags out further than people really wanted it to, and because vaccinations, as you can see, are not going quickly, and now we have new iterations of the virus, which it's not even completely clear whether the vaccines will address. You could also have things go south pretty fast, and that will revive, I think, a lot of the, bad feelings about, or good feelings about, the last president.
Peter Jensen here from the Baltimore Sun and the editorial board there. Make sure you're going out reading and checking it all out, staying up with everything. It's a shame we haven't had you on in 2 years. I promise it won't be 2 years before we bring it back.
Thank
Unless you,
Nestor.
Want it to be.
Well, let me give that a thought. But Nestor, let me say first, 99 cents to subscribe. That's the current rate. And secondly, we're all very proud of you. Thank you for representing.
Well, I'm glad I made you proud. I'll continue to try to make you proud. How about that, Pete?
There you go.
Peter Jensen, I would say down on Calvert Street, because that's what I used to say, but I drive by there and I realize you're not on Calvert Street anymore.
No.
But my heart is, for sure. Peter Jensen of the Baltimore Sun, joined by my partner in crime, Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller over in Catonsville. We're going to State Fair. We're going to El Guapo. We're ordering those crab cakes from Fadley's. And we're getting ready for, getting ready for the impeachment next week. We continue to talk to local leaders. You can hear Brandon Scott. You can hear Barry Glassman, Johnny O, all out at BaltimorePositive.com.